Now it is my privilege to introduce the president of Wells Fargo Securities, John Weiss. John has been instrumental in creating a world-class banking platform for our clients. He is also a big believer in the power of nice. In an industry known for sharp elbows, John has fostered a uniquely collaborative culture that has attracted some of the best talent in the banking industry. Please welcome John Weiss.
Good morning. Diane has undercut me from the start by calling me nice in a room full of bankers and investors. Obviously, we're just getting started here, and I'm going to try and wake you up a little bit and get some brain waves going. When I was thinking earlier this morning about some comments to make, the theme that kept coming back to me was the theme of incongruities. I feel like we're in a period right now full of incongruities. Some would say we're in the most peaceful era in the history of man, and yet we're facing all sorts of dangers around the world. A global world where globalization has really taken the day, and yet regional and even tribal conflict all over the place. An economy in the fifth year of expansion, and yet most average Americans not really feeling all of those benefits. And I could go on and on. A healthcare system that is finally approaching universal coverage, and yet all we hear about is Ebola and whether we can tackle that problem. A government dominated by extremes and no center ground, a widening gap between rich and poor. It just seems to me that incongruity is the name of the day. And it's not really uncertainty. I mean, we have a stock market at all-time highs. It's certainly not the crisis of confidence of the Carter years, but it does seem a strange place for us to find ourselves in 25 years this week, I guess, after the fall of the Berlin Wall. It certainly doesn't feel like unity of purpose. Our job during this period, and any period really, is to engage in thoughtful discussion and debate to help our clients make sense of the world and explore ways to capitalize on these incongruities. We do this with award-winning independent research that Diane leads, and that I think importantly, it's not based just on individual company analysis, and certainly not based on short-term gains, although we like those, but it tries to explore strategies that cut across asset classes and themes that cut across industry sectors to identify risk and to highlight opportunity. I think we've invested more in our research platform than probably any firm on Wall Street in this period post the financial crisis, and you can expect us to continue to invest in our investment banking platform overall and research in particular with the objective of providing differentiated service, insight, and capital to our clients and to be reliable and steady and strong when or if incongruity turns into something a little more exciting. Segueing to our speaker here, one of the incongruities highlighted this week is the paradox of the unbridled power of the internet and yet a government determined perhaps to restrain that or regulate it. I think no one can give us better insight into this debate or into his own company's recent announcement about expanding in Mexico, cutting back on CapEx, than AT&T's chairman and CEO, Randall Stephenson. He's well known to this group, so I will not read his bio. I will not mention Oklahoma football. I will say he's been with the company since 1982 when he joined Southwestern Bell. CEO since 2007, on the board since 2005. He's chairman of the Business Roundtable, and something that resonates with us at Wells Fargo very much a champion of education and college career readiness, which is something I think many people in the room recognize the importance of. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce Randall Stevenson, who's going to be here with Jennifer Fritchie from our research group for a fireside chat. Randall, thank you for being with us. Thank you.
So in the last 6 days, I've had a lot to talk about.
Me too.
And I just want to address, I think, what we can call the elephant in the room here. On Monday, President Obama released a statement which indicated that the FCC should reclassify, let me get this straight, consumer broadband service under Title II of the Telecommunications Act. This has obvious implications for your group and many of your peers. Can you talk about your thoughts as to how this statement of reclassification will affect your commitment to invest in broadband?
Sure. If I could, was there a safe harbor statement up there a minute ago? So just draw your attention. Some of these statements will have forward-looking comments. And most importantly, we're in the middle of a quiet period with the FCC and their auction for spectrum, so I'll be able to address nothing about spectrum.
Perfect.
So that said, that's all right. It's been an interesting, actually, couple of weeks as it relates to the regulation of broadband services. Chairman Wheeler at the FCC had been on a fairly assertive push to work with, he was working with almost everybody in the ecosystem, the internet service providers, carriers, and even people in the content side of the house. And he was doing a very diligent effort trying to see if there was a way to kind of thread the needle of the existing rules that would give a lot of the protections that the president said he was looking for in his statement Monday in terms of, you know, no fast lanes, slow lanes, paid prioritization, none of that, and transparency. And there was a few key areas that he's been trying to see if the existing rules could be accommodated to fit and put some prophylactic measures in place to give people confidence and comfort that those types of actions wouldn't be taken. And so we were all working this rather diligently, and the president, whether you agree with it or not, Monday made his statement that you outlined, and it brought clarity. And it basically laid out a position in terms of what his expectations were for how broadband services would be regulated. And very literally, what the president has outlined is a regulatory framework that says from the last mile broadband service all the way through to the backbones, the internet, into the content providers, those would explicitly be regulated. It's effective end-to-end regulation of the internet. And again, whether you agree with it or not, it provides a lot of clarity in terms of what the objective is. Now, other clarity it brings is the time horizon that's involved in what we're trying to accomplish here. Chairman Wheeler was on a path that, you know, we were hopeful that maybe you could carve some path that would get us to some quicker resolution of this issue. The president's proposed path has one of two courses to get there. One is through Congress, and there could be congressional action that would give the authority to do what the president has proposed. I don't envision that happening in the current environment. So the other path is you go through the FCC, and the FCC issues rules that would affect what the president has wanted, regulating these services. Now, the issue and what brings clarity to the timing is that the rules that are in place at the FCC, there's been an extensive rulemaking process, a record established for 20 years now, that says what the president wants, the rules don't accommodate. In fact, the rules say just the opposite, that these services are information services and not telecom services. They're not subject to that kind of regulation. 20 years, multiple administrations, multiple chairmen and FCCs have supported that ruling, and then that has been actually upheld by the Supreme Court of the United States. So if you want to go down this path and allow the FCC to make this determination that these are, in fact, regulated services, there is a mechanism at the FCC to do that. And by the way, the FCC has to do this under full knowledge and full expectation that what they do will be litigated. I mean, just there is no doubt whatever happens here, either way, is going to be litigated. So they need to do a rulemaking to basically say what we have said up until 3 years ago turns out not to be the case. It's actually this. And so something has to have changed. And so that rulemaking is called a notice of proposed rulemaking. They send out for information. They accumulate a lot of information. They put out a proposed rule. They have hearings. They have comment cycles, reply comment cycles, more hearings. Ultimately, a rule is voted on, and assuming they get a 3-2 vote, the rules are implemented, and then the litigation begins. So we are probably in a, I think, best case, one, most likely case, 2-3 year time horizon for addressing this in terms of what the president aspires. So that's kind of how we assess it, and this is the process we anticipate is going to be the case. For the next couple of years, I think the rules that we all operate under are not likely to change if that's where we go. What are the implications to the industry and as it relates to capital investment? When we initiate projects, fiber projects, building new cellular infrastructure, these are 2-3 year efforts. And while the rules probably are not going to change in the 2-3 year time frame, we are now starting infrastructure projects that we don't have any clarity or line of sight in terms of what rules those will be governed under. So you're doing multi-billion dollar investments, and you really have no clarity in terms of how those investments will be regulated. That can have no effect other than to cause one to pause. And, you know, I can give you examples. We made some commitments in the DirecTV announcement that we would build fiber to 2 million additional homes. We will obviously commit to that. Once the DirecTV deal is done, we'll keep going. But what we have also announced on top of that is that we're going to deploy fiber to 100 cities. And, look, we can't go out and just invest that kind of money deploying fiber to 100 cities other than these 2 million, not knowing under what rules that investment will be governed. And so we have to pause, and we have to just, you know, put a stop on those kind of investments that we're doing today. You could go through, there are other services you want to deploy. We were investing in in-flight connectivity, meaning getting LTE service delivered into airplanes so that you can have high-speed connectivity across the United States in airplanes. Literally, if you were to put these services under Title II, it becomes unclear even how those kind of services would be regulated. And so we just think it's prudent to just pause, all right? Let's pause. Let's make sure that we have line of sight and understanding as to what this process looks like, where these rules can conceivably land, what those rules would look like, and then let's reevaluate. But we're in a pause moment right now on those kind of investments.
And on Friday, you made an announcement about moving CapEx for 15 to about $18 billion.
Right.
I think some people are kind of confusing this pause with that. Can you clarify that? That $18 billion is, my understanding, really about a pullback being done with Project VIP. Is that correct?
Yeah. For the last 3-4 years, actually, we have been running at a torrid pace in terms of investment. And we announced our Project VIP, which had several piece parts to it. And we have literally been investing for 4 years now at a, I would consider, a historic pace. I'm not sure you could find a 4-year string of time where a company has invested more in the United States than we have over that period of time. It's been a 20-plus billion dollar a year effort, plus spectrum acquisitions, plus fill-in investments, you know, acquisitions to improve our footprint. And so we spiked our CapEx. And we spiked it considerably, $21 billion we've been running the last couple of years, to do a handful of things. Build out LTE nationwide, 300 million pops, 300 million people covered by it. We hit that number mid-year this year. That was a huge spike in capital spending. We hit the 3 million number. Our coverage is by and large complete. Now we just have the normal capacity and so forth. So check that off, all right? Now that comes out of a 2014-13 run rate, and you bring that down. We also made a commitment that we would take high-speed internet, increase the speed significantly to 57 million homes, and improve our video footprint. We are at 57 million homes. That number has been achieved. Check. And actually, we achieved both of these well ahead of schedule. Take that out of the run rate. We also had a commitment that we would deploy fiber to 1 million new business locations around the country. We have gotten the fiber actually to 650,000 business locations, and we're now on the doorstep, if you will, of most of the other buildings. As we sell the services, you take the fiber to the last step. So we're kind of on a success-based run rate for that fiber now. So that one is by and large complete. We have a little bit more to do there, but not a ton. And so you go through this and you say, okay, here's been the run rate. Those projects are finished. We spiked it. Now we're bringing it down to a more normal rate. And I have said consistently when people ask me, what should I think about in terms of capital requirements for this business? I say, take our normal service revenues, multiply it times 15%. If you're in a spreadsheet, do a click and drag as far as you want to forecast, and 15% is kind of where we live. With this reduction back to 18% or $18 billion, taking those projects out, we're now back to kind of a normal 15% run rate. And this is where the business lives long term. I mean, there will be technology migrations that will cause you to bubble again over time, but by and large, this is where you live.
And with the news from Washington and your comment that there is maybe some need for pause, could that mean that $18 billion next year could actually go lower until we get this clarity?
Yeah, we built the $18 billion assuming that we would keep the pedal down on these additional cities deploying fiber into those. I hope we're not sitting here on pause for an extended period of time until we have line of sight, but we are on pause, and so that would obviously have implications there. But for right now, I'd tell you, just kind of put an $18 billion number in mind.
Got it. You also on Friday made a big announcement, an expansion into Mexico for the purchase, or announced intention to purchase, IUSSL. This will be the first ever North American mobile service area, including the U.S. You'll be covering 400 million pops. Can you talk a little bit on the logic to getting there? What does this mean for AT&T in terms of this expansion?
Sure. It's kind of ironic, the timing of all of this, that I became very enthusiastic about Mexico after spending time with the senior leadership and the administration there, and I have been very, very impressed by President Peña's rules that he's put in place for telecommunications and liberalization of energy and so forth, and they have literally made constitutional changes to implement changes in the telecom law that make it very, very attractive for companies to come in and invest in new technology, new coverage, new footprint, and so forth. And it's an interesting time when you have a government there who's incentivizing you and motivating you to come and invest. At the same time, we're sitting there going, oh, my God, how do we invest in the United States, right? What are the rules? What are they going to look like? And a lot of uncertainty and lack of clarity. But to step back from it, when we did the DirecTV deal, it required us to divest our interest in America Mobile. It's been a 20-plus year partnership with America Mobile, and I've lived in Mexico. I know that country well, and I love those markets. I love the Mexican market particularly. And so when we sold our America Mobile investment, we felt it was really important that we stay involved, particularly in Mexico. DirecTV has an extensive footprint throughout Latin America. And so we began doing a lot of work in Mexico, and USSL became available. We look at buying USSL. They cover 70 million people around Mexico right now. And the opportunity to go into a market like Mexico with a very impressive middle class, it's a middle class that's growing, it's a very young population, its economy is very, very vibrant, and the telecom rules are very, very attractive for us. And so to be able to go down to Mexico and build out that footprint with a market that is really tightly integrated with the United States and create, as you called it, a 400 million person service zone, mobile internet covering 400 million people. And by the way, the mobile internet is really undeveloped in Mexico right now. It's not a very good experience anywhere in Mexico. So the ability to get ahead of this mobile internet revolution, which is coming, this is just a mechanical thing. You know the mobile internet revolution is coming to Mexico, to Latin America, and so forth, just like it has to the United States. So the ability to get in, invest in front of that, create a market that literally has an on-network experience, regardless of whether you're in New York. You get on a plane in New York, you get off in Mexico City, there's no reason why that would look any different than getting on the plane in New York and getting off in Arkansas, all right? Just the economics work exactly the same. So we're very enthusiastic about going down and investing in this. We think it's going to be a terrific growth opportunity.
A lot of people have asked me this week, and I'm sure my peers, is this the first step? You know, what about the AMX piece, American Mobile piece, rumored or speculated to be for sale, Nextel in a restructuring stage? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so USASL is a terrific platform. I mean, they have a very nice spectrum portfolio that covers the whole country. The network needs to be built out a little bit more. Are there things that one could do to accelerate that build? And obviously, we do a scan. Nextel International looks interesting. Nextel International is in the middle of a bankruptcy process, though, right now, and it's kind of hard to look into that and see exactly where that comes out. But they have a very set of Mexican assets that we would find attractive, and we would obviously have to look at as there becomes clarity on how the bankruptcy process progresses. America Mobile, that one has a lot of uncertainty surrounding it right now. What assets would actually come out of the business, and under what structure would they come out of the business, and how will the government view the proposal that's been put in place by America Mobile? And it's a very uncertain situation for us. And so we believe we have found a path here that gets us a very nice, scalable growth platform without the American Mobile assets. If things materialize over time and those look attractive, you'd obviously have to look at them, but we really don't need the American Mobile assets to be successful.
Okay. I want to shift. You have another big deal on your plate with DirecTV. Can you talk a little bit about the logic of DirecTV? Verizon, who will be speaking later, has been pretty public about the fact they don't feel the need to own a linear TV. You know, you'll be right shoulder to shoulder almost in terms of size with the new Comcast in terms of number of video subs. Can you talk about the thoughts about content costs and the main logic of the DirecTV deal?
You look at our consumer home solutions business, which is, you know, broadband and TV business, and it's growing nicely. The investments we made in broadband are really paying off. You know, that business has gone from shrinking by virtue of the VIP investments. It's growing 3 to 4% fairly routinely, quarter in and quarter out. To be in that broadband business, you have to have a TV offering, and without a TV offering, you don't get the broadband business. We're subscale on TV. You know, we have 15, 16 million broadband customers, but we're new in TV, so we only have 6 million TV subscribers. And it doesn't scale, probably in the terms of my career, to a place where it becomes a profitable TV business because of the content costs. And when you're subscale, the content costs basically eat up all the margins. And so we have a TV business that's losing money, and DirecTV was the most logical transaction I've looked at in a long time, because acquiring DirecTV, bringing their content cost structure onto our TV business, makes our TV business suddenly profitable. As you point out, it suddenly makes us a meaningful player in the TV business, linear TV business. In fact, post DirecTV, we will be the largest paid TV provider in the world. And so it makes us not only profitable in video across the board, but it gives us a nationwide, ubiquitous TV footprint. Today, our TV footprint is a bit spotty. It's where we've built out, you know, the TV capability. With DirecTV, we cover 100% of the United States. That overlaps very nicely with a 100% coverage of the United States with our mobility business, our mobile broadband business. With the mobile broadband build-out we're talking about to rural America, gives us a very nice overlap of broadband with a TV product that is a best-in-class TV product, best-in-class content costs, best-in-class margins. So this is something that from just a pure strategic standpoint, feels really good. It has a fundamental shift very quickly on the cost structure of our current businesses. And then it also puts us in a different place as it relates to the future of content. And what I mean by that is we've been very diligent about, as we negotiate content deals, ensuring that we get the mobile rights to that content. So we work that very aggressively because we sell TV service, but we also have 100 million wireless subscribers. And we want the ability to deliver that content wherever the customer wants it. With 6 million TV subscribers, you don't quite get the same receptivity and seat at the table to get those mobile rights. We've gotten a number of them, but not as many as we would like to have. DirecTV, on the other hand, has not had a need for the mobile rights. They have not been very aggressive at pursuing those. We put the two companies together, and with the scale and the size of 27 million, 26 million TV subscribers, 100 million wireless subscribers, seeking those mobile rights becomes a very different conversation. And so we're very excited about that. Combine that with our partnership we've announced with Peter Chernin to deliver an over-the-top capability to our, actually developing it in general, but then delivering that into our mobile subscribers over-the-top looks to be a very exciting place. So you put these all together, we suddenly become a more meaningful and relevant player in the content business.
I can't not talk about the state of wireless competition. I think you said last time how many price changes in the third quarter alone?
45. I don't remember any of them being upward.
Okay, right. Clearly the landscape is changing. Can you, in the past you've called it, I think, an open field running type of environment. How are you feeling about it now? Has anything surprised you on the downside? And where do we go from here?
No, it's hyper-competitive, make no mistake about it. We set out 5 years ago, which very first, one of the first questions to talk about our CapEx spending, to say we're going to differentiate ourselves. And we're going to differentiate ourselves in terms of an overall customer experience, network quality, network performance, and then the customer experience in the retail store and in the online store. And so we have been investing at a torrid pace to build that capability and to build a very significant, we think it is the premier smartphone customer base, not only in the U.S., but in the world. This is an unbelievably robust postpaid smartphone customer base that we have built. And so our objective is to differentiate ourselves there. Now, obviously, players get really aggressive in the marketplace on pricing. And when you spend as much money and invest as much money as we have over the last 5 years to build this capability and this customer base, you're going to be very aggressive in defending that customer base. And so as the competition really intensified in the beginning, actually end of last year, beginning of this year, we made a fundamental move on pricing to just shore up our customer base. We thought that was too important. We cannot compromise the customer base. And so we made a pretty big move in the first quarter. And as you watch the year progress, second quarter, we had our company's best ever churn performance, the lowest churn we have ever had as a company. And in fact, as far as we can find, it's the second best churn statistic ever posted in the industry over any period of time. So we felt really good about the moves we made. Third quarter, similar result, a best in class churn performance, best in the industry, and our best third quarter churn rate ever. And that's in a quarter when we launched an iPhone, which you always see new iPhone launches. You get a spike in churn as customers take advantage if they are going to make a move during those times. So we had really good performance. Actually feel good about how we positioned the company. Pricing is going to keep moving. We'll have to continue responding. The open field running comment is, so somebody asked me, what's T-Mobile or Sprint going to do? I have no idea. This thing's open field running. They're going to do what they do, and if we need to respond, we will. We're going to preserve the customer base, but we don't think we need to be a pricing leader in this premier smartphone customer base. To the extent that we want to get aggressive on pricing, we have purchased a business called Cricket, and we have been very aggressive at that end of the market. We've been working the transition. We just closed the deal last year, so we've been transitioning, changing out technology. Now getting in the marketplace, expanding distribution, you should expect to see us get very aggressive on pricing at that end. We already have been, but we'll continue to be very aggressive on pricing at that end. And by the way, that customer base at Cricket way over-indexes to the Latino markets, and we think this is going to be a really powerful combination with our USASEL acquisition in Mexico. There is obviously incredible amounts of cross-border traffic between Cricket and companies in Mexico, so we think that's going to be very powerful. And there's one more synergistic piece to that I would point out. As we've kind of gone down this path in the intensely competitive environment, we put in place our handset financing program, Next. And so customers basically step into this, and they have the opportunity for a new smartphone every year. So these smartphones get traded in. the ability to refurb these and have a ready market in Cricket, our prepaid service in the United States, and think about taking them south of the border to Mexico and getting a really low-priced handset to deliver in Mexico. We see this as an incredible opportunity just to kind of recycle these phones and get maximum utilization out of them.
You touched on this, Randall, but I wanted to ask a question because I've gotten it. You know, with the pullback in CapEx, you obviously have a rockstar wireless network right now. Some of the naysayers might say you're going to starve the network given the pullback in CapEx. And from what I'm hearing from you, that's a huge part of your network, your messaging to the marketplace. So it's fair to assume you're going to continue to spend, maybe not on coverage, but capacity. And without touching the spectrum issue, is that a fair statement that that's a huge focus for the company?
We're still going to spend $18 billion in capital. Okay. I will be surprised if that's not the highest U.S. CapEx outlay in the country again in 2015. Mm-hmm. In fact, I'll be very surprised if that's not the case. And again, we pulled off a bubble. Building out 300 million POPs for LTE is a massive bubble. We're going to pull down. I tell you, I have been in my career two times through network service quality issues. Once after we bought Ameritech back in the early 2000s. And the second was after the iPhone launch when the volumes just swamped the network. And those things cost a fortune to fix the network and to get ahead of the brand issues. We are ahead of the brand issues. The network is performing best in class in reliability and quality. There is one place that you should rest assured we will not go, and that is compromising on best in class. Not only good, but best in class network performance. That is our aspiration. We set our investment plans up to achieve that. We'll continue to invest more money than anybody else in the United States, much less in the industry.
Perfect. Wireline. Wireline margins have, you know, continued to be pressured. Content is obviously a large piece of that. But beyond owning DirecTV and getting those costs down, what turns those wireline margins around?
Well, you hit the biggest one. That one moves the needle. Okay. The margins on the wireline side have been most pressured by content cost increases. So we have content cost price increases every year, and you cannot, you know, pass all those price increases on to the customer. And so you just have a significant margin compression from that alone. DirecTV takes a big move on that, all right, and really changes the margin equation over the next couple of years on our fixed line business. So that's point number one. Point number two, when you spike capital investment in this industry by $3 billion a year, which is what we've done, you spike capital investment, there is a trailing operating expense that goes with that. It's very mechanical and it's very predictable, and just the cost to be putting away this much investment, there's just a big operating expense block that goes with that that we have been dragging through the last 3 years as we did all these build-outs. As we move into 2015, and you'll see in 2014, the fourth quarter, that CapEx start to tail off. That operating cost, we call it a trailer, that trailer goes with it. And those operating costs will come out, and they will come out, and it's a not inconsequential number. I mean, we have incurred a lot of dilution to do this build-out over the last 3 years, and that operating cost will be coming out, and that's not an inconsequential number. And then we have routinely and always going on some what I'll call really significant productivity initiatives. We have one right now. It's called Project Agile. And we feel really good that we have line of sight over the next 3 years to pull $3 billion of run rate cost out of the business. You'll see a big block of that hit in 2015, 16, and 17. And so there are a number of initiatives in here that anywhere from call center consolidation and call center optimization to things that we're doing in the field, retail store type work. And so there's a lot of effort here that's going to pull a lot of cost out. So, you know, we actually feel pretty good about our ability to stabilize the margins on the fixed line side of the business. And as the content cost savings begin to roll in, the CapEx comes out, you know, margins will begin to move up fairly expeditiously in a reasonable time frame. And then there are some longer term things that are probably the most exciting that we're doing. We are aggressively working a transition to an all IP network, Internet Protocol network. So our old legacy networks We're working with the FCC and all the state regulatory authorities and legislatures. This is requiring many states' legislative authority. We're getting a lot of this done. It's being knocked down gradually. The FCC is working this. But to move to all IP, as we do that, the operating and capital costs that come out of this business from retiring those old legacy systems and networks is significant. This is one of my top priorities for the next 5 years, is to get this conversion done. It's really, really exciting what it does to the cost structure, but more exciting in terms of what it does to the speed of the business, to roll out new products, new capabilities, repricing and so forth. It really changes the velocity of the business. And then we haven't even touched yet on everything that's going as we make this migration. It's been going for the last couple of years, but think as we move forward. Project VIP is behind us. Project, or our LTE bill. Now as we add capacity going forward, all LTE, that capacity is 40% more capital efficient than the prior technology. So you just have some natural efficiencies from being on the new platforms. Rather than deploying old legacy transport to cell sites and to businesses for your high capacity data needs, we're using Ethernet, 40 to 50% more efficient to deploy Ethernet from a cost standpoint than it has been the old legacy stuff. That is now 90% of what we're doing in the marketplace. And I can just keep going. Our Domain 2.0 project, where we're taking cloud technology into the core network. So our global backbone network is going to be, think of it as a cloud-based software-defined network. The cost savings from that, as we make this migration over the next 5 years, are dramatic. It fundamentally changes the cost of operating a core global network. So you stack all this up, we feel like we're on a path over the next 5 years to put this company in a place that is a best in industry cost structure, and we think best in the world cost structure.
And the IP transition, you're testing two markets now?
We have it up in Austin. It's been up in Austin for a while, and it's impressive. It's giving us conviction on, number one, how the customers receive this. So if it's in University of Austin, we have deployed this technology, and it's, think of again, as cloud-based core network architecture. We've deployed this technology, University of Austin. They need a new Ethernet circuit, VPN capability. They provision that circuit themselves in 60 seconds, all right? Today, broadly across our footprint, that circuit takes about 60 days. So we're going from 60 days to 60 to 90 seconds. Now think about what that does to the cost structure, the provisioning cost structure, the capital cost structure, and think about how the customer responds to this and how quickly they can do bandwidth on demand and what that does to bandwidth requirements. So I'm really excited about this.
Terrific. I think we're out of time. Randall, thank you so much.
Of course. Thank you, Jennifer. Good visiting with you.
Really great way to kick off our conference.
Good talking to you.
Thank you.